Okay. So, hi, welcome to the Prismatic Pioneer podcast. This is my very first time doing a podcast, so we'll just bear with me and hope that I don't mess this up royally. No. So I have decided to do a podcast, because I have been thinking about like how I use my voice lately, and I've decided that, you know, forever and ever I thought, okay, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna be a blogger. I did blogging in high school. I wrote all sorts of things every single day of my life for like most of my high school career. And I can safely say that I think I'm a little burnt out on blogging. And honestly, like, I think it was a lot more in the moment. I think that when I was in high school, it was a little bit easier for me to just go ahead and say what was on my mind and not have this moment of like panic around like, who's going to listen to this? Who's going to read this? Like, and plus it was, you know, what boy maybe that I was like trying to allude that I had a crush on, or like what songs I was listening to, or like how my heart felt in the very moment of being like a teenager full of angst, dealing with like a whole variety of family issues. But nowadays I'm like a little bit more aware of the people that are out there and around me, and just thinking about maybe the type of voice that I want to provide myself or have in 2017 as a person who's like, you know, politically invested and at the same time not wanting to think about politics at all. I'm wanting to, you know, kind of talk about what's going on in my heart and in my life and what's important to me. And so I do a lot better with conversation. I think that as a double Gemini, Gemini sun, Gemini rising, I'd get along better. It's a lot easier for me to talk one-on-one with somebody. I think there's a lot more of a depth that comes out between conversation, within conversation, I should say, rather than trying to like write a blog post. Cause all I do is find myself like looking at it, editing it, changing words around, deleting sentences, deleting paragraphs. And pretty soon, like all that's going on is that it just seems like a bland piece of poop. I don't even want to post anymore. And I'm usually not happy with it. And then I never do it. And I say, well, that was a waste of like an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours of my life that I'll never get back. So, you know, I was thinking about just like, I have a studio in Salt Lake. I'm here in Salt Lake City, and I find myself having these really great moments in my studio, whether it's like with the other studio mates or people that come by and visit, where like I'm having these really great conversations with other people that I know in my life that are maybe makers or artists or just friends of mine, like interesting people that I really love and admire for one reason or another. But this is like when I find that I'm in my like super flow and that the depth of my conversation really comes out. So, you know, I just thought this podcast forum format is like a pretty cool way to kind of give some perspective on maybe what's going on in my life and get to know some of the other people in my life or people that I'm wanting to know in my life or been following in my life and admiring, or, you know, there's just this whole untapped category of things. So the first podcast guest that we'll have tonight, her name is Samantha Zangrilli, call her Sammy. But I met her in Chico. I mean, it's been like 4 years since I've lived in Chico now, or I lived outside of Chico. But I met her and her husband, Cheetah, and they were just starting out on this little journey of having this little farm, that I'm excited to talk to her a little bit more about tonight. But yeah, it's just been interesting. I've moved away from Chico, and I stay in touch with everybody on the internet, via the internet, and it's just been this really neat thing to watch myself finding myself. I'm just curious about the people that are in like these growth patterns, these patterns and places where they're like really doing a lot in their life and they're trying stuff out and they're failing, or maybe they're succeeding, but they're like sharing that experience in like a pretty tangible, practical way where they're like, you know, living on a farm or, you know, doing things with their hands, kind of working in these ways that seem really like old and primitive almost, or like folk arty, like a folk art lifestyle or like a farm culture lifestyle. In 2017, you know, like here we are, we're in this place where we, everything's available to us. We can buy groceries on Amazon. And yet there are people like Sammy, and her husband and so many other people that I know that have just like decided, well, you know, F that, I'm just gonna work on doing this like way more local and way more sustainable. I'm gonna try to figure this out on these kind of intrinsic levels. So as I find myself getting more and more passionate about food culture and farm culture and how it's become so much a part of my life and it's really grounded me, I find myself following other people that are kind of more tapped in or more dialed into those parts, or have really made those pieces of life part of their everyday experience as well. And really have, you know, found myself kind of watching their path and watching their journey. Cause I kind of did a thing where I stepped out of that. I moved to Salt Lake and I decided, oh, I'll volunteer at a farm, but I won't have a farm, or, you know, I'll just invest myself in these, like, I'll go to the farmer's market and shop local and organic versus growing all my own food. And really my art has taken me in a very different direction, but it hasn't been lost on me, all of the things I learned when I was living in Chico and working with natural dyes and weaving and spinning. And, you know, it's really become part of who I am even still here in Salt Lake, but I'm just more fascinated with people that are even, you know, this is their everyday thing. This is like day in, day out. This is what they do. So I think this podcast is pretty much an opportunity for me to start to navigate talking to some of these people a little bit more in depth and seeing, you know, what it is or what life is like for them on the other side of the coin. So I guess I will go ahead and call Sammy.
My name is Samantha Zangrilli, and I own a farm with my husband, Cheetah Tootie, in Yankee Hill, California. The farm is called Turkey Tail Farm. And on the farm, I am a shepherdess, I'm a faltress, I'm a mycologist, I'm an artist,
wow,
a steward, a homesteader, and a maker. We have 40 sheep, 80 ducks, 9 pigs, 5 dogs, and 4 to 5 cats. We're sending a feral cat right now.
That is so many animals. Is that like completely overwhelming sometimes or what?
Yeah, sometimes we're like, oh, we just want to sleep until 10 and not feel super guilty.
Yeah.
But I love it. And I think when it's overwhelming is when we have chickens. Oh, I didn't even say how many chickens we had. We have 300 chickens right now.
When you have chickens, do you end up using them for meat? Are they like meat chickens, and then, or do you just have them as layers, and then, or what's the chicken deal? When you have chickens versus when you don't? Yeah.
Yeah. So the chickens, we're ranchers, we're meat farmers primarily. So we raise lamb, pigs, and chickens for meat.
Okay.
And then we have the ducks for the eggs.
Okay.
So yeah, we have the chickens 3 to 5 months out of the year, but we raise chickens. We hope to raise 3 batches of chickens a year. So
wow,
basically we have chickens 9 months out of the year.
Oh my gosh. These are crazy. I was kind of, I was reminiscing about, when I met you, when I lived in California, just before I got on the call with you, and was kind of talking about, I think that you guys were just getting started. Like, how long have you guys been, like, I know you guys were running, you had called yourself Turkey Tail Farms, but like, maybe it was an evolution of, was it your parents or his parents, or like Turkey Tail was something else, and then you guys really took it on and have been doing that ever since I've known you. But I feel like it's steadily gotten more and more like all inclusive, like that's all you're doing now. And before there was like a little bit more of like Cheetah was doing something else, and you were maybe doing some things part time, but now you guys are like full time farm. And how long has that been really going on for overall?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we are first generation farmers, so we had to have side jobs before we could really dive in. And it's just because we can't support, you know, a farm with the money either.
Yeah.
So I quit my job in 2014.
Okay.
And then Cheetah was still working at Sierra Nevada. He was the organic gardener there, providing food to the pub and other various avenues.
Yes.
And he just quit his job this year, May of this year, 2017.
Okay.
So we're really going full force now. But we when I quit my job in 2014, we had a face. We were getting more of a face. Like, we did a redesign, and I was going to Thursday Night Market again and marketing to Chico Natural Foods. But it really was in the very beginning, it was his family was here and they started the farm,
right,
and wanted to have a family farm. And then I met him, and he just needed to get a job. So the family farm was kind of put on hold so we could make some money.
Yeah.
Cool. And then we decided to get married in 2011. And then that's what kind of shot me into doing Turkey Tail.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Well, that gives me a little bit more background. I was trying to consider, like, because I know we live down the street from each other. We never really saw each other. We kind of had like one or two brief encounters, but I just, like, I've always known about you guys, but I just, it's been so interesting and so like wonderful for me to be able to kind of, like, now that I don't live in California, like, witness what you guys are doing from afar. It's really something special. I just really have a great time watching you guys do your thing, and watching you guys on social media. It's been really inspiring. So
thank you for all your support, and for following us and enjoying it. I mean, we do it for other people for sure. We're not raising all this food just for us and trying to get all this interest in clean food just for us. So
I think we did a pig roast down at the beach at Wyatt's. And I think that was like, and you guys had raised that pig, and that was, I was like, wow, this is amazing. It was like so local and so fresh. And we were just like so stoked on that meat. I remember feeling really awesome about that whole experience, and that whole celebration was just like super cool to have everybody from the community kind of gather around and like cook a meal and hang out together. And I just, it was delicious meat. I'll say that.
Yay.
Yeah, full of love. Okay, so you said that you would love to sleep in until 10, but obviously you don't. I guess that kind of will like roll me into my next little bit. Like, what, when you are talking about like a typical day at Turkey Tail Farms, what does that look like for you?
I just recently hired somebody, so now we're definitely on every morning at the same time, trying to be consistent about that.
And nice.
For the sake of the employee. And so we start around 7, mm-hmm. and we start with chores. And so we have to do, you know, ducks, all the waters, collect eggs and feed them. Chickens, feed them. And same, lambs and guardian dogs, feed them. And then our guardian dogs sometimes need medication. And then we have to feed the pigs and water them down. And then we usually water all the starts. And then we talk about the projects we're going to do that day. Depending on the day of the week, we either harvest, make bunches, or wash eggs. Or we go to a sale. So we have a farmer's market, Thursday night farmer's market that we do in Chico. And then we go to Grub, CSA Farm, and we sell to their members. And then we also have a CSA, so we weigh out our member shares, weighing out meat and mushrooms. And then we usually have some, after lunch, we do house chores and then try and go to sleep.
So you're in bed by like 5:30 or what's up?
Well, we try and like do other projects, but it's just kind of miscellaneous organizing and stuff like that. Our intern works, or our employee works, until probably about 2 or 3.
Okay.
And then after that, Tina and I are just doing busy work until the sun goes down. So moving stuff or weeding randomly or working on different random projects, you know, like put a hook there, or let's move all of this stuff over here, or I have to inoculate, or print something out, or make an update, that kind of stuff. Yeah. We're always working on farm stuff, like how to move our farm further down the road. And usually it's like moving stuff around and buying more stuff.
Always got to have more stuff. I know. I feel like, can't we just ever get to the place where we don't need to buy anything more? But I don't know. I think that obviously that's just maybe a pipe dream that I had. Like, I was like, oh, you know, I'll just, even with like making jewelry or something like that, I'm always like, oh, I have plenty of beads or plenty of this or plenty of that. And then like we'll make a few pairs and be content for like a month or something like that. And then I'm like, oh, you know, I really just need some more beads. Like I need different colors, or, you know what I mean? It's like, this never ending, whatever it is that you do in life, you always just need more, I guess. And part of my plight with, especially like, of course, taking care of other, like your animals, like that's when I realized, I'm talking just basically from like household pets, like I went from one dog to two dogs, and I thought, oh, it won't be that big of a deal. Like, it just really can't even be that much more, but it is double the food. I'm like, double the dog is double the food. And that is like an insane feeling to have to go through twice as much and twice as much money for one dog versus two dogs. I'm like, I mean, what did I do to myself? But I can't even imagine having, I don't even know. So you, do you have a total animal count? Like if you added all those animals up together, do you know how many animals total that you're responsible for?
Yeah, I can do that math right now.
While we're on the
phone.
Wrote
it all down.
So,
I was going to say there's certain things like egg wash. I go through a lot of egg wash, and that's something I buy at the feed store. Like, I'm always buying, my shopping sprees are farm consistent.
Okay. Like, so you're not going on clothing sprees?
No, I wish. I just spent $1,000 on a pallet of food, and yeah. I just spent like $400 on all those chickens.
Yeah.
And if you want to make money, you have to make enough product to satisfy your customer because you want demand, but you don't want to run out of supply. So,
sure.
And for us, it's frozen meat, so it's like now we have dreams of having our own walk-in freezer one day, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's a huge pipe dream, but it's going on the wish list.
I mean, really, like if you're going to be doing meat farming, that's a huge thing, is keeping it like as fresh and as frozen as possible, like as soon as it's done, you know, so they can be like delivered to customers in style and be the best product ever, you know. I'm working with a flower farmer right now, and so she's just moving spaces and kind of transitioning, and she's also like a florist and floral designer, so she is like having these dreams about coolers and upgrading space to make more space cool so she can store more flowers, you know. And it's like, it's always just about how much you can handle in your little life to like hold all the things that you are dreaming about farming or, you know, having on hand for whatever you need. So it's just a part of like growing your dreams, I guess, you know. So yeah, I get it.
Totally. I would love a walk-in cooler
right?
for my flowers. OMG. This would be so great. I've had dreams of that too.
Well, she was talking about some like amazing little, like, I think it's like it hooks into like an air conditioner, like a freestanding air conditioning unit. It's called
Coolbot.
There it is. Yeah. And I was like, oh, and she's like, yeah, it's supposed to be amazing. Everyone's raving about it. So I don't know.
It totally works.
It does?
Yes.
Do you have one?
Yeah. I have two farmer friends in town. One is a flower farmer specifically, and the other one is a vegetable farmer. The flower farmer converted one of those, like, wooden sheds that you buy, like, from whatever, Amish or Mennonite people or whatever, just on the side of the road, you know? and it totally works, especially for Chico heat. And the other one converted a storage container, and they have two going on each side, and it totally works.
Oh, so, cool.
Yeah.
I'll let her know.
Those are even so much money. Those are like a grand, the, you know, those kinds of storage containers sheds are like a grand each.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. They're not cheap.
One day.
Okay. So I wanted to know, like, so we talked about, like, that this was, like, a family farm idea from Cheetah's family, like, to begin with. But, like, how do your dreams or your ideas on, like, having and running a farm, like, come about? Like, how did you find yourself? I mean, obviously meeting Cheetah. But, you know, as you see yourself and in the past before Cheetah or coming to this place that you're at now, like, how did having this idea of having a farm really come to be?
In 2007, I went to Africa on a study abroad trip for 6 weeks. Mm. And that was my first trip ever out of the country.
Wow.
Was Ghana, West Africa.
Whoa.
And yeah, it was great. It was definitely the experience I was looking for. I wasn't looking to be pampered or your average, I'm going to study abroad college student, you know. I wanted to go and, like, be shocked.
Sure.
And I was, and it was fun. And I still have the same experience. I still got super drunk and, like, hung out with people and did things I wasn't supposed to.
Oh, well.
It was just riskier. And so it gave me, a sense of, like, getting away with a little bit more and, like, being able to take on more, I guess.
Yeah.
Emotionally and physically, because it was super hot. And I also was taking dance classes there. Like, it was required that you had to take, like, one more unit. And I thought the dance class would be easier than the language class. And I was, like, totally wrong. Oh, God. I totally kicked my ass.
Wow.
But I made some really great friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just came back from that experience and had culture shock in America, and was like totally hippie, and I was like, we should be living in communities and we should be providing for each other, and I was kind of like on this rant. And I met Francine Stupelnagel from Grub. She was starting her front lawn gardens.
Yeah.
And so I became their first intern, and then that's when like farming became really real to me as like a profession. And I started taking more environmental classes. And then I graduated and I went on bike rides. And so I was living in this kind of, you know, sustainable community on bikes and stuff, and was traveling around with a band. So total hippie.
I wasn't going to say it, but you're just spelling it out. So it's fine.
And then I lived in the community, Grub Cooperative in Chico.
Mm-hmm.
So we had 14 members on 40 acres, and it was a farm, and we were living, you know, we had meetings every week that went from feelings meetings to proposal meetings, and we took nonviolent communication, and we made meals and had chores.
Yeah.
So that's where I met Cheetah, and he was just so smart. So cute and super kind.
Dreamy.
Super dreamy.
Uh-huh.
And we fell for each other, and we fell for each other because I did, you know, I went on that life experience. I had all those life experiences, and I realized that I wanted these kinds of qualities in a guy. I wanted somebody who thought about the environment and thought about how he could help it, or at least not trample it so much.
Yeah.
Somebody who wasn't too concerned about material wealth, but who was concerned about prosperity and, like, wealth in the sense of health.
Mm-hmm.
Health for himself and health for the environment. And I don't know, he, at that point, he really made me love farming. I didn't love pulling weeds in the hot sun.
Cheetah. It's all about Cheetah. Yeah. Cheetah's got your number, dude. He's the one who turned you on, huh?
Yeah. So I was like, now I get to hang out with this really cute, attractive person who has so much knowledge.
Amazing.
And then once I started doing it all the time, it felt better, and it felt like I should be doing this. This is what makes me tired and feel satisfied and happy at the end of the day. And not only is my body feeling it, but my heart and my soul is being nourished at the same time. So, yeah. Going on my life path and finding my life partner has really made me the person that I am.
Yeah.
And I'm better for it.
That's awesome. So, yeah. Okay. So it was like a co-dream. You met the dreamy dude at the dreamy co-op, living the dreamy life and pulling weeds. And suddenly you guys were like, yeah, let's get married and have a farm. Sounds rad. So I see it. I see it all. It's very cool. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like a fail.
So I guess that kind of touches into my next little piece is like, what do you love about your farm? Like, obviously you love weeding, or you love, maybe you don't love weeding, but that's the thing you've grown to be okay with. But what do you love about your farm? What do you love about doing it?
Okay. I have two separate answers. One is very basic and one is very deep.
Okay.
I love all the animals and I love my dogs. My dogs are so precious to me. They're my children. We're not going to have children. We don't need children. I added up the number. We have 430 animals that we're responsible for.
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe you just did that. I'm so amazed right now. Also, can I just interject? I love your dogs, too. And when Cheetah posts these little posts about him training your dogs, and you guys post these, like, amazing moments with your dogs where how they're listening so well, they're, like, fully in, like, the zone with you guys, I'm like, if only my dogs can be this amazing too. Like, my dogs are work dogs also, but they're just so city bred right now that it's insane to me. Like, I work tirelessly. They're intelligent, right? Like, work dogs are like, you're going to train them, you're going to communicate with them, they're emotional. But like, when I see videos of your guys' dogs, I'm jealous. Like, my dogs are a little too like free spirited. Like, they act out so crazy sometimes. And I'm just like, oh man, I need to find a farm for you guys to live on quick, because this is getting out of control. So yeah. Yes, I love your dogs too.
Oh yeah, they are very good listeners. Cheetah's alpha for sure, and the border collies. I definitely have to be stricter with the border collies than I do with the guardian dogs, because the guardian dogs, they just break my heart. They're supposed to be incredibly intimidating, you know. So nobody fucks with them. I hope I can cuss on your blog.
Yeah, let's do it. Do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're just puddles of fluff, because I have just loved on them so hard when they were puppies.
Sure.
Because I just never wanted to unlove an adorable fluff, you know, like we went to conferences and stuff and they talked about how, oh, guardian dogs, don't touch them when
right?
they're puppies.
Oh my gosh.
Don't give them praise.
How do you do that? No, it's not possible. I remember Mandy was trying to raise some, like, she had the first round of guardian dogs up at Wyatt's goat farm. And I remember being like, she's like, well, you just have to come in backwards and, like, don't look at them in the eye. And, like, and I was like, oh, my, they're like little tiny baby puppies. Like, I was like, no, I just want to snuggle them. It can't be.
But yes.
Do you find that because you coddled your pups, your fluffs, like, are they like less intimidating? Do you feel like if you would have just like done the deed and been like the stone cold biatch to your dogs, like, do you think that they would have been better somehow, or I just feel like, I don't know, like those things, I feel like dogs are so instinctual, like that they're just going to get it. Like you can treat them with kindness or whatever, but they know that they have a job to do. And the more that they're doing their job, the more they get that they're intimidating on their own right outside of like human interaction. So I don't know. Do you feel like that it's changed your dogs, or do you feel like your dogs still do like an incredible job doing the guardian job that they are set out to do?
They're still incredible dogs. They're still on it all the time. Yeah. They back each other up. They're constantly barking at deer and at predators, and they are what keeps our flock safe.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that like, I don't know if it's because, our flock is smaller. I mean, it does make a difference if you have thousands of sheep.
Sure.
And my flock also loves me. They follow me. Like, we just moved them the other day, and, like, we didn't even need the border collie. The ewes were just like, where are you going? I'm going to follow you. So they know me. And the dogs are, they're still super intimidating, super great, right up until you pet them. They want you to pet them, and then they're cool. And then they're like, okay, you're cool.
Yeah.
I like you.
Okay.
And they're so sweet with kids. They're just sniff balls with kids. It's adorable.
Nice.
The other thing I really love about farming is when I talk about the border collies specifically, is when the act of when we move our sheep with our border collies is it feels so ancestral to me, like and traditional. People have been using this technique for thousands of years to get the job done, and that's where a lot of my passion comes from out here, is being so connected to the land and knowing that we're not the first people to do this, and we're not going to be the last, but we're keeping the tradition alive right now, and we're utilizing what we have because it feels good to us, like it nourishes a need that we have. Like Cheetah loves the border collie sheep relationship.
Yeah.
He wants to teach classes and be a border collie trainer.
Yeah.
And
he could be.
I mean, I want to learn. Yeah.
Yeah, he's that good. He could do it.
He could totally do it. Yeah. I keep telling him that.
Yeah.
So that's a big part for me. It gives me such a sense of mystery and wonder and adventure and thrill. Because when all the sheep are loose, there's always, like, a sense of, like, anxiety and adrenaline.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So I don't like it when animals escape. I'm, like, super nasty about that. No escaping animals allowed. If you escape or if you're temperamental, you're out of here.
Only obedient sheep need apply here, because Turkey Tail won't take the disobedient sheep that tries to run. You gotta fall in line over here at Turkey Tail.
There's too much work to do to chasing animals around.
Oh no, totally. Oh my gosh, so many hours spent just like wondering where animals are. I know there's like, I don't know. A lot of my other farmer friends, like if they've lost, like the mokes, they'll lose goats or whatever from time to time. And it's so stressful just even hearing about it. You know, sorry, my dog is totally going off at the neighbors. But yeah, so this is kind of what I wanted to touch about, what you just talked about with the like touching into the ancestral, like, this is kind of why I'm starting this podcast, or well, what used to be a blog and now a podcast, is because I'm really interested and really think it's interesting the amount of people or the types of people that I have discovered along my path that are really interested in like old ways of doing things, or like keeping traditions alive, or like, you know, I consider myself a folk artist because I seem to gravitate towards arts and crafts, hobbies that are like pretty much archaic, primitive or whatever, you know, like throughout time, like this has been a thing, like drop spindle, who drops spindles, right? You know, like, okay, I'm a 31-year-old living in a city and I'm like spindling, like drop spindling and spinning on a wheel, and people look at me like I'm like from another time, you know, and I'm like, well, But I love it, and I feel like that whole piece of being connected to this piece that is so old, but it can be, you know, carried on throughout. It's timeless, you know. It's got a time. It's got a feeling of being dated, but it's also a timeless skill that is carried, needs to be carried on, and you know, who. It always just seems really amazing to find or to like touch on the people that are like carrying on these tools and these skills until like 2017. Cause here we are, we're like, Donald Trump is our president. Like the future of farming seems like kind of crazy. And like, I was just watching a Vice about like the Cavendish banana and how like our rainforests are like disappearing, and the strain of banana is like contaminated, and we only have like so many more years with the perfect yellow banana, and scientists still can't figure out how to genetically produce another banana that Americans will buy, because they only will buy bananas that are like yellow without brown spots. Nobody wants a brown spotty banana, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm like, man, like, where are we? What is this time that we live in? And yet, even still, there are people like you and me and so many others that are just like carrying on the traditions of the old ways of doing things, and finding a lot of joy and a lot of like peace and prosperity around carrying these old ways into the future. And I think, you know, I that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk with you tonight about like all of this stuff, because I'm really thinking that this is like an important piece of keeping the stories and keeping like our culture alive, and not like, you know, so that we don't turn into the Cavendish banana, and you know, we don't turn into this thing that gets lost and forgotten, you know what I mean? Like this role of like, as much as it's, you don't think about it on the like day-to-day level, like it's a really important thing that we're doing by keeping old traditions alive, you know? So
yeah.
I want to say thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. You're so welcome. Oh, thank you for just asking me to be on your podcast.
Well, you rule. How could I not? I was like, oh my gosh, I'm just so excited. And like, honestly, like I would say this out loud, like we just really haven't gotten to know each other. We were in passing and like spent this overlap of time in the same place. But like, you know, I really was so isolated in my own experience out there in California. And like, I was saying this before I even got you on the phone, like I learned so much and had so much like amazing time spent learning my spinning and cleaning fleece and working with natural dyes. And, you know, I had this consolidated amount of time in California where I really got to like learn a ton. And then I all of a sudden was like, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to go back to Utah and see what the city life has to offer me, and kind of step back into quote unquote reality. And, you know, reality doesn't stop, even though you live on a piece of land and you don't go into town all the time, like that never goes away. And so like, it was kind of jarring when I first got back, but then I find that the pieces that really have grounded me are the pieces that I like carry from that space and time in my life, like the dying and the kind of finding the rhythm of the earth and being with the earth wherever I am. Like it's pretty much the only thing that grounds me these days, because my life is just like a series of like running around and phone calls and emails and whatever like city life looks like. It's crazy. And the way that I really ground into like my own space and deepening my own like kind of spiritual practice is by doing like tangible folk crafts and things that I really picked up in that Northern California space. So, but yeah, like we just really haven't had a time to like kind of get to know each other that much other than through social media. So I was really, really, really jazzed to be able to be like, okay, cool. I'll just find out about her, and then the rest of the world will find out about her all in the same shot. It'd be amazing. So, yeah.
So. I want to say that I think people are attracted to old ways of doing things and traditions, because it's a way of being sustainable. With that, even that word, sustainability.
Right.
Doesn't mean anything unless you put it into practice. And we try and create all these different ways that we can be sustainable. And so we look towards the past, because what did we have before plastic? What did we have before petroleum-based fertilizers, you know?
Right.
What did we have before the herbicides? Oh, we had two hands, and people were working in the field, getting to know each other and feeling nourished at the end of the day and having really great food,
right.
You know?
So, yeah, I know.
It totally makes sense to me why, especially in cities, people are feeling so attracted by the old, because the city is so overwhelming. It's go, go, go. You're getting stressed out. You have to pay for rent, and there's no heart nourishment unless you seek it out.
Right. Well, I can safely say, like, I'm happy. Like, people are always like, oh man, it must have been amazing to like live out in the woods and live off the grid and da 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 da. And I was like, in so many ways, yes, you know what I mean? And then in so many ways, like, stepping back in to the real world, quote unquote, I don't even want to call it the real world, but like, you know, just kind of having this like day to day, like city traffic, or living, you know, where there's freeways really like close to your living space. And, you know, I there's something that's really convenient about cities, and there's something really cultural about cities too, that like I was missing on a deep level, when I was living so alone, and not seeing so many people. I mean, it was amazing in so many ways, but I definitely can see where I was like not sharpening my social skills, and I wasn't really practicing being part of a community, even though I had like a distant community in like far reaching parts of Concow or Yankee Hill, you know what I mean? Like, there was people out there that we knew, and we'd see like maybe once a week or, you know, a few times a week, but I would never really feel like we had this time to really like spend getting to hone our communication and like interpersonal skills. Like, it was definitely like just me and me and me sitting with all of my garbage and all of my emotional drama. And like, it got really heavy. It got really hard being out and being alone all the time and not really having anyone.
Yeah.
I was saying, like, I'm a double Gemini. I just really needed communication and community, and like, I didn't really have that. So I also see myself really like overjoyed that I have this city life now. And I've kind of like worked my way back into feeling more comfortable about being kind of in the zone, so to speak. But then having those pieces of my farm experience, or my like, I don't even know why we'd call it a farm, but like, we were, you know, just like the back to the land moments that I had out there were like,
yeah,
the things I can carry on and just carry on in my day to day here. It's like the blend of two is really powerful for me. So, you know, I don't know. I see the farm life and I'm like, yes, I'm like, someday I want to get back there, but I want to take like my city and my farm life and somehow put it together, because that's just the type of person that I like have discovered that I am, you know. And it's not, I'm sure there are people that can totally balance that out better, but like, when I was out, I just really struggled. I remember like having these like epic like ugly cries out there, like, what am I doing and where is anybody and I'm so alone and you know. And I was like, oh my okay. But I do that here too, but just not as much. I don't feel as like disconnected, so to speak. But you know, most Americans, most people in general, just like don't really get that kind of time with themselves. So I don't know. I just feel like it's got to be amazing to have. Do you feel like that you get, do you have like a pretty deep sense of who you are and how you are after being on a farm? Do you feel like you have a good sense of who you are because you sit with yourself so much, or like that you have a lot of you time, that you and the animals, or you and nature? Do you have that sense of like kind of deepening your connection to yourself?
I honestly like I have a lot of opinions about politics that I don't get to talk about a lot because I don't have anybody to talk to, and I have a lot of questions. And so like, I know who I am, Like I'm a homebody, but I also like to go out and have fun,
and I'm
loud, and I like to be creative, but I also like love to work. I love to work, and I don't need vacations. I've realized that about myself. I don't get a lot of vacations, and so when I go visit family, and/or when I get to go just to the lake or whatever for the afternoon, it feels great, and that's really all I need. I need, and I'm realizing what I need around me is more people like me.
Yeah.
I can't, people who say, you know, they never get a vacation or they've been working nonstop, you know, it's like, man, try being in my boots. Like, I'm really working nonstop, you know, it's from dawn till dusk, and then sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know?
Right, depending on the farm emergency, right?
Exactly.
Right.
And so, I mean, parents have, are running right along with me, but it's definitely not as multifaceted.
Right.
Like, with parents, it's just the one child. With me, it's 430 things that could die at any second.
Aren't you glad you figured out that number? Now you can say, I have 430 tiny children that I care for every day. Amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Good intimidating number.
So is there stuff on the farm, like, that you meet, like, so we've talked about the things that you love on the farm and the things that, like, bring you the best, like, is there stuff on the farm that you, like, what don't you love about your farm, or things that you didn't realize that you were going to, like, run into that were going to be, like, challenges on the farm that you're kind of just over, you're just like, you know, fuck this.
Yeah, there's a couple of answers to this. The number one answer, and then it has a couple of different categories, is nature. Mother Nature is a really rough mistress. I mean, she's going to let you know over and over again that she's in charge. And that comes in different avenues. Predators are one thing.
Yeah, what kind of predators do you guys have out there?
Well, we just recently had foxes attacking my ducks at, like, during daylight. So, like, the earliest attack was, like, at 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, my gosh.
And the fox just kind of nosed. He or she climbed a tree and jumped over my electric fences. And I hadn't put them away in their coops yet because it's only 6 o'clock. And just, like, grabbed one and jumped up the tree and then ran out.
Mm.
And then so foxes were really bad for a while. We do have coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
We've had bears. But most recently, right after the fox attack, we had a mountain lion attack.
Yeah.
And that killed two of our ewes, and he didn't even eat them. He just, like, killed them and ripped their throats out.
And just left them?
Yeah.
Were you able to skin them for, like, you know, like, hide and meat and stuff at least then?
No. There was already blood in the meat, and they were already bloated.
Oh.
And my husband does that. I don't do that, so he doesn't. I don't make him deal with bloated carcasses.
Sure.
So predators are always, like, a huge challenge, and it's always like, fuck that shit. And my husband gets really mad because he's like, that was $400 and we're totally out. And I'm more like, okay, well, that's just kind of our nature tax. That's our Mother Earth tax for the predators. Like,
oh, yeah.
They were here before us, and so I'm okay with that, but they can't be taking stuff all the time.
Sure.
So that's why we got the guardians. And I'm pushing for more guardians, actually.
How many guardians do you have per pen? Or do you have multiple pens? And do you have multiple guardians in the pens?
Yeah. So we have electric fences for all the animals. So the ducks have their own set of electric fences. The chickens have their own set. And the sheep have their own set. We only have two guardian dogs, one pair, and they're with the sheep full-time now because of the mountain lion attack.
Okay.
Where we were kind of moving them where we needed them.
Sure.
So now I'm like, okay, well, I guess the poultry needs its own set of guardian dogs, and our sheep block needs its own set of guardian dogs. Sorry, my dog is being weird. Carl, stop. He's scratching his back.
Oh, okay.
You're being noisy.
Well, that's okay. It's the best.
So yeah, predators are big. The weather is also like, fuck this.
Yeah.
Those crazy storms we just had, like 100-year storms, we've had to get up at like 2 o'clock in the morning and T-post our chicken and duck pens down because the wind was so strong. It was moving our duck and chicken pens and squishing animals in the middle of the
What?
night. Yeah.
Oh my
So it's just
gosh.
crazy stuff like that, like you gotta constantly be checking the weather. Especially and in the summer now too, like we have 300 baby chickens, so if it gets to be 110, I have to go out there and make sure they're cool enough,
Yeah.
make sure I like water them down and stuff like that. So the other thing is unexpected challenges. It's just like really hard lessons learned. Just like being first generation farmers, there's a lot that of awful stuff that happens that nobody will tell you about unless they feel comfortable. Like farmers come across dead stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes it's nature, sometimes it's your fault. And one of the things that Cheetah and I really talk about putting in our book, because we talk about writing a book, is like those awful mistakes that you make that you never want to make again, that nobody ever tells you about because it's embarrassing. And it kind of shows that you don't know what you're doing. But if you're learning, how else are you supposed to know? So, like, there's this awful stuff. Like, I'll share a really awful story that you can put in the podcast if you want, or you don't have to. But
Okay.
we got the guardian dogs, and they were doing great, and we were lambing, and it was kind of, I think it was like my second year. Definitely being on my own lambing, so having baby sheep. And I wasn't jugging, putting them in their own pen when we lambed. We were just kind of letting them have their lambs wherever they wanted. Like, this is how novice we were,
Right.
And so we were watching them and keeping an eye on them. And once they had the lamb, we would move them to their own pen. And we kept the guardian dogs in there. And so the guardian dogs love to eat the afterbirth. And they realized if they just waited around while the lamb was giving birth, they could just go for it. And one of our guardian dogs got a little too ambitious and started eating the baby lamb. So,
No.
yeah. So that was awful. I felt like a failure. But it taught me to get to whip my shit into shape.
Right.
And I made a whole nursery and jugs the next year. I was on top of it and put lamps in, and I had somebody come over and tell me the signs of early detection for birth. So I would just jug my ewes as soon as I thought they were going to give birth. I just put them in the pen, check
Yeah.
on them 3 to 4 times during the night,
Sure.
12, 2, and 4
Yeah.
o'clock in the morning, and we separated the dogs.
Yeah.
The whole time. So the dogs were separated from the flock for like 4 months, which is a long time.
Sure. Yeah, that's a long
So
time. Well.
it's just those kinds of lessons that we've had to learn, where we're just like, fuck this, man. Like, when are we gonna get fucking ahead of the game? And it's all about experience.
Right fucking now is what you say. Right fucking now. I'm gonna do it right fucking now. Well, that I think it comes with anything. I was actually thinking about this today is like, how do you know unless you do, right? That's like the whole thing about being a doer is like you really, especially if you're not gonna wait around and find like the master mentor or be in an apprenticeship, like there's a lot of people that go that route just to kind of like have somebody give them that like wisdom, and oftentimes they'll pay like a ton of money to like have those experiences, which I've done in certain parts of my life, and like have had like master workshop opportunities, of course, but like a lot of times if you want it to be your life or your world, and if you want to completely immerse yourself in something and you don't have the time and or money commitment to like lay down to say like I want to do this, you just end up doing it as it comes and figuring it out on the fly, and I don't think that that's a bad thing. You know, I think that almost it gives you like a certain level of depth that you almost don't get if you're like being like groomed, so to speak, by somebody else, you know?
Yeah. You get to make your own mistakes.
Yeah. You get to be the nitty gritty farmer. You're a nitty gritty farmer for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, right? You're nitty gritty.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And look, sure, you read plenty of books and you do as much research as you can online, sure. But sometimes there's those mistakes that nobody really wants to admit to. And I practice humility daily, you know? And if we're talking about, like, you know, going back to tradition and going back to doing things that are the old way, and in the olden times, mm-hmm. this is how people learned too. They didn't have the internet. They just went out one morning and they were like, oh, fuck, that animal is dead. What did I do wrong? I'm going to try not to do that next time.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah, totally.
I can't pay for an apprenticeship. I don't want to go anywhere else to learn. I want to learn right here at Turkey Tail Farm, you know?
Yeah, and like, you guys are blessed to have a piece of land to work on, and so, you know, take the blessing and go with it and make your mistakes and figure it out as it comes. Like, some people don't even have the opportunity to find land or don't have the land to begin with, you know what I mean? I think that, so everyone's starting mm-hmm. in a different place, but if you have land and you have these dreams and desires, like, why not just start, you know? It's good. It's good to just start and have it be a natural progression over time. So, okay, well, I guess that's going to kind of lead me into, I'm going to circumnavigate a question and come back. When you are looking into the, like, not so distant future, what is the evolution of your farm as you know it right now? You guys were saying that you wanted to do some old world practices, but like, what's the vision for Turkey Tail? I mean, you guys are doing a lot right now and doing, how many members do you have in your CSA right now? Let me just ask you that.
We have 10 members and we just did a push. August just started and we try and do every 3 months. So August to October is what this next, membership is. Can you hear my father-in-law playing saxophone?
I can't, but I would be, if it picks up on the recorder, then cool. I'll be stoked. I'll just work it into that.
Okay, cool. Sorry.
No, it's okay. Everybody's trying to have their Sunday. It's all good, right? Sunday saxophone sounds sweet, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The dog might start to howl. That's the only thing.
Perfect. I love a good dog accompaniment.
Yeah. So we would ideally, I mean, I would like 20 CSA members. It's all about how much freezer space we have. Mm-hmm. So we're looking into buying more freezers and how much product we have on hand. Because people want variety. They don't want just the same thing. But our hope for the future is to have 20 CSA members to keep going to Thursday Night Market and just being a huge staple at Thursday Night Market, having a bigger shelf space at Chico Natural. So we sell lamb there pretty well. So growing our lamb flock, so maybe having like 80 sheep in the near future instead of 40, so we have more product available.
Sure.
And also, I want to be a famous farmer. I've always wanted to be a famous farmer. One of my idols is Joel Salatin.
Right. I saw him speak in Chico. He came through when I was there and gave a talk about raising hens and talking about moving his grazing flock around and into, you know, fields of natural herbs like the clover, and, you know, so that they were eating stuff that was like keeping them healthy, just because they were grazing stuff that was like medicinal for them and their natural diet, you know. I was like, oh, amazing. But yeah, Joel's a good person to reflect on if you guys are in the meat farming industry, for sure, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I read I'm trying to read all of his books, and I read one, finished one recently, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal by Joel Salatin.
Oh, yeah.
And it hits so close to home, and it's so true how the meat industry makes no sense whatsoever about health quality.
Sure.
And just like being a good company to work for.
Sure.
And how the little guys are always being made to go through more hoops.
Right.
And because the big corporations don't want the competition. So my hope for the future is that we get so many people that are passionate about wanting clean, humanely pasture-raised local meat that will be like Joel Salatin, where on our harvest days, on our chicken harvest days, people show up to our farm, you know, and buy the chicken right there. Like, that's what I want for the future.
Yeah.
Because their food is important to them.
Oh, yeah.
And they see the value in what Cheetah and I do. Like, we're trying. We just want to make clean, unadulterated meat for our community and let them have that option.
Right.
Because so many of the choices are nasty, factory farmed, disgustingness.
Oh yeah, I just bought a quarter cow at the farmer's market here. So I put my deposit down or whatever for whenever it's going to be slaughtered, and we were talking about it, and I was actually kind of on the hunt for brains because I brain tan, and so I was like, oh, I'm gonna try to find some brains, and nobody will sell me brains or pass on brains to me because of mad cow and how it's like kind of illegal to talk about, like, even I'm like, but in reality, like, wouldn't you see that a cow was like diseased or whatever, like, long before you ever slaughtered it? And they're like, absolutely. And they're like, honestly, it's not even like they're talking about the U.S. now, really. Like, I'm sure that there are people that are doing crazy stuff everywhere, but, like, largely the USDA is, you know, eradicated or whatever mad cow thing was going on. However, this whole conversation started about meat being labeled from other countries and the country of origin. And, like, if you're buying meat where you don't know the butcher or the farmers direct, like, and you're buying it from a grocery store that you may or may not trust entirely, like, the amount of meat coming in from other countries is kind of large, and that they don't have to put that on their packaging, that it's coming from somewhere else, and that the standards in other countries isn't necessarily as up to. Not that I think the USDA is really the be-all end-all, because let's be clear, I don't. But I do think that there has to be. Like, I mean, it's just the same conversation if we're talking about herbs and herbal regulation or whatever too. Like, there's, especially here living in Utah. I don't know if you know much about Utah, but it is like one of the largest like natural health food distributors in the nation. Just because there's so many like multi-level marketing. Places here, like Mormon culture is huge and has infiltrated a lot of, like, they do natural ways of living and, like, you know, essential oils and teas and whatever. Like, it's like a big deal to have like herbal companies and herbal supplement companies here, but the regulatory process on like what's in any of those herbs and herbal compounds is, like, you know, left to the imagination sometimes. And I think that, okay, so I'm on the coin of, like, I'd like to know what's in my herbs, and so obviously I go with companies that maybe aren't local, but I definitely know that they're sourcing their herbs in a way that I feel, you know, that I've done the research or I've met the people themselves, you know, I tend to just go with what I know. But, like, how many people are really buying stuff that they don't even know anything about? It's so scary to me. It really is. I think that this is ultimately, like, another reason why I hope this podcast is something that people will listen to and take to heart. It's like, people like you are essential for the future of food, you know?
Yeah.
And I was really blessed to feel like, you know, in Chico, there's, so, I mean, it's such a fertile area, the Sacramento Valley, and like everybody that's kind of in that Northern California region, like, there's so much going on in the way of like good food, and I feel like I got really super spoiled out there. Just came back and was like, what am I doing? Like, where do I shop? You know, it's like, but I realized that that's like that's the American way. Like, when nobody knows anymore what's going on. So of course we need you to be a famous farmer, because we definitely need more of this going on so that we can talk about this more openly. Because I almost, I feel like this is like Okay, so you're talking about not being able to talk about or like voice yourself politically, like because you spend a lot of time alone or whatever. There's not like, this is like pretty political. I have to say, I think that if I'm talking about what I feel most passionate about and how like it directly like overlaps into politicians' pockets or big corporations' pockets, like the food and drug industry, so to speak, is like the place where we are in the scariest place we've ever been. And this is like a political stand to say like, I'm going to grow my own food, or I'm going to grow food for my community, and I'm going to, you know, be the cog in the wheel, so to speak, so that I don't have to subscribe to what you're feeding me. You know, like people don't even go ahead. Sorry.
Well, you're totally right. People have no idea. And then what the information that they are fed about the food system is either half of the truth or greenwashed in some way. There's so much greenwashing going on, and people don't even know what greenwashing means.
Well, can you tell us what greenwashing is, just for everybody that is going to listen to this? Go for it.
Absolutely. So greenwashing is like putting a fancy spin on a title or a word and making it seem like it's something that it's not in an organic or sustainable way. So like naturally raised doesn't mean anything. There's no standard for the word naturally. You have to pay for the word organic these days. So that's why people just don't outrightly say my stuff's organic.
Sure.
Like there's a difference between me saying my stuff is naturally raised means that I'm not going to spray herbicides or pesticides on it. But Foster Farms saying that their chickens are naturally raised means that their chickens eat actual food. They don't feed them arsenic or something, because they do that.
Oh, my gosh.
But the grain that they're feeding those chickens can be GMO, soy, pesticide, herbicide-ridden grain. They're just calling it naturally because they're feeding them grain instead of ground-up cats and dogs, which they also do.
Oh, my gosh. This is a downward spiral conversation. Oh my gosh.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There's also things they do like another greenwashing is local farmers, and they say that like, you know, the farmers are from California. Sure. Buying a product, if I'm living in California and I buy a product from California, sure, that's local. But really, what the word local is trying to get to the core of is your neighbor, 100 miles. We would say less than 100 miles. So they're kind of diluting the intensity of that word by using local to describe something that's, you know, 1,000 miles away.
Sure.
You're still having to transport that product with petroleum, and adding fossil fuels to the, or adding carbon monoxide to the atmosphere. So the other thing is that people aren't going to stop eating meat tomorrow. People aren't going to stop consuming cheap food tomorrow.
No.
So when people tell me, like, we were just in an article in the CNNR about our meat CSA, and we talked about how we humanely raise the animals because we love them and we treat them great. We move them onto fresh ground every 3 days or every week. We give them fresh water. We give them misters. I have an umbrella out there for my ducks right now, you know. We give them ice cubes and frozen watermelons and
luxury
supplements, stuff like that. So our dogs get frozen meat in the summertime, and they get hot soup in the wintertime, you know. So this is what I mean by when I say humane. And some people just can't wrap their heads around the fact that, you know, you can raise something and love it and eat it. It's not humane if you kill it, they say. And sure, that's not, I'm not trying to be a vegan, or I'm not trying to save the life, like save all lives of every animal, Haro. I'm just trying to make sure that this particular animal is feeling honored and happy throughout its life.
Yeah.
And that when it can be made into food, I do it in a loving way that is fast, clean, and efficient, so that I can get it to the person who needs it for nourishment, who needs it for medicine, you know. And that's where I think a lot of our mission or goal as meat farmers is lost on people because they just automatically think, oh, humane. It can't be humane if you kill it.
Right. Yeah.
So, it's just so narrow. It's such a narrow way of thinking.
Well, I have a lot of vegan friends that care very much about animals and never want to see them die ever, you know, but, and mm-hmm. I totally respect, you know, everyone having these like deep feelings about animals. And I obviously don't want to see any animal in misery ever. So I'm on the like vegan team, so to speak, when I think about like the fair treatment of and ethical treatment of animals, but I'm also very aware that my body is like the most efficient being doing the B12 and the B, you know, all the B vitamins that come from meat. For me, like my body is just at its prime and my mind is at its prime when I'm having my B vitamins. And so I do choose to eat meat because my body runs so much better. I feel like so much more clear when I'm on that type of diet and lifestyle. It's just how I function. I'm a person of the North. If we're talking Game of Thrones, I'm from the North. And you know, and that's just my, I'm come from Danish and Russian and German stock. And we, you know, I grew up with a hunter gatherer family, so to speak. My family hunted pheasants and snow goose and deer and elk, and like, so I've grown up eating game meat for the most part, but the understanding like of the relationship between, and that's the important part, is like, for, and that's where that I, for me, I've taken it to like, okay, I'm going to use all parts of the animal, or I'm going to honor all parts of the animal. And so learning how to brain tan has been a really or learning how to spin the wool, or using how to like tanning sheep hides, or, you know, like those kinds of things are the way I can honor like parts and pieces of the animal's spirit, or like the protein, the memories of the animal, you know, because proteins are memory. If we're talking about intelligent information, we carry a lot of memories. It's how the Navajo grow their hair out, you know, because they think there's all the story, they know there's all the stories in their hair, and they only really cut their hair when there's a death in the family or an illness, you know. And so I think about this because, so when I was Lynn Chico and taking these knitting classes and learning how to spin and how to shear, there was a time where, so my friend oh my gosh, I'm gonna totally space her name. Oh my God, I want to say Miriam, but that's my shopmate. Why can't I think of her name right now? It's going to come back to me because she's like so part of my Chico experience. Anyway, she taught me how to spin. She had a flock of 10 and she taught me how to shear. But then the animals would get released out after they'd been shorn and they would be bleeding out in the field. Like, who am I? Who are you? You know, and I'm like, why are they all standing like so far away from each other? And why are they, because they were so huddled right before that experience, you know, when they are flock animals. So I was really confused. I was like, why are they doing this? Like, does this hurt them? Does shearing hurt the animal? And they're like, no, like it's definitely like uncomfortable. And like, of course they can get nicked or whatever, but mostly all of the information about who they were was on their backs, you know, and the protein like was really telling and indicating of who that animal was to another animal. So once that hair was gone, it takes them at least like 2 or 3 days for them to really come back together and say, oh, like, there you are, brother, or there you are, sister. Like, you know, it was so mind blowing for me to say, oh, like the protein is the information, you know? So anyway, I think that's how I can carry it on in my day to day. Like spinning is part of like me honoring animals. You know, if I'm shopping locally, I'm shopping at these little local butchers downtown, and I really appreciate the methods and the quality of the animals that they're butchering. Mm-hmm. But if I can't do it myself or whatever, and I can't have any more of an intrinsic part in my community, like the most I can do is like touch the animals' hair and spend time with it and like connect with it. Like knitters, I'm sure knitters can just get down with it, even vegan knitters. Like you're touching this wool didn't no sheep died, you know, but but there's a story in that. And even if the sheep did die, like there's a story always on their backs, and like So I really appreciate, I think that it's so important that you are doing this kind of work, this like treating
Thank
the animals
you.
With, because you can see it on their backs. You can see it in
you
their
can taste
pelts.
It.
Yeah, you can taste it, right?
And you can taste it.
Right.
For sure. Absolutely. Well, and it's also, I mean, a factory farmed meat in so many ways is adulterated. It is defiled and it's poked and prod and it's bit overfed, nasty GMO, pesticide ridden, petroleum fertilized, antibiotic ridden feed. And these animals don't enjoy their life, and the workers who work there are being tortured as well. So it's just the whole system set in place.
Yeah.
When you buy regular factory farm meat, you're buying this animal that was tortured, and you're also buying it from somebody who hates their job. They hate their job. They're not passionate about what they do at all.
Sure.
And they're being underpaid. Yeah. And in chicken production specifically,
yeah.
These people are not being allowed bathroom breaks, like specifically. They have to wear adult diapers. So it's like slave work.
Wow.
And a lot of our meat does come from Mexico or China. And a lot of the Chinese workers are indentured servants.
Yeah.
But, you know, like the factories that make all the Walmart crap.
Yeah.
All those people are indentured servants. And so that's what you're supporting, where you can spend a couple more dollars on meat and get it from Cheetah and I. You know who we are. You can shake our hands. And, you know, we're the one. That chicken didn't go anywhere. That chicken came in the mail from California to my house and stayed on my land until we sold it to you.
Right.
You know, and then we gave all the blood to our dogs who love it.
Yeah.
And all the chicken guts to our pigs who love it.
Love
Nothing
it.
Got wasted.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And for us, it's a totally closed loop system. Like all those feathers and guts and blood, we're going to put it in our soil as well as give it to our dogs. And then it's going to be nutrients for our garden next year.
For future. Yeah. Yeah. That's important.
Yeah.
And people always say that this is always the thing that I'm always like amazed when they're like, it's too expensive. You know what I mean? Like the cost. And I'm like, okay, well how, I'm not trying to say like, put back some of the shit that you've got in your cart. But like, if you could just think about like feeding yourself like the highest quality food, like, and then just existing in that space all the time, like you don't need that much. You don't need as much as you think. Like it's all this filler food and all this stuff that we say like, oh, we need to have so much. Like vegetables on the whole, like don't cost that much. Like yes, it's expensive to buy vegetables. If you're buying organic, it's more expensive or whatever. But in reality, if you're eating meat and vegetables and like high quality meat and just like filling your plate with vegetables, you can be full off vegetables and meat. Like people are in this whole like, I just can't get enough food and I have to like substitute with like potato chips or tortilla chips, and I'm like, okay. Like I just put that shit back and like buy a nice piece of meat for yourself. Like you're gonna feel better, and maybe you won't even want those tortilla chips next time around because you'll be so much more satisfied with the quality of like nutrition that you're getting from feeding yourself well, you know, versus like feeding yourself mediocre but larger portions, you know. I don't know, the American way is just kind of backwards.
It is. And a lot of people these days, I mean, they've talked about how millennials don't even know how to boil an egg. A lot of people don't know how to cook or make the time for it or think it's too difficult. There's all these like, there's all these companies now where you can order a meal and it has everything you need in it, especially and a recipe. And, you know, that's our CSA. It's just, we give you a recipe in our newsletter and suggest things that you should make. It's just, it's frozen and you've got to do it per week. It's not like every day we're shipping you this box of pre-cut things.
Right.
We were just talking about how in our next newsletter we're going to compare our CSA with Blue Apron.
Uh-huh.
And Blue Apron's not even organic.
No.
It's just like regular Cisco stuff.
Sure.
And it's just it's the convenience. It's TV dinners 1950 all over again, you know?
just repackaged into a millennial packaging. I know. It's so funny, but there's these apartments being built behind my house right now. And I looked at the buildings, like there's two buildings that went into like a very tight space. And we were like, well, what's up with these buildings? apparently they don't even have kitchens in them. It's like San Francisco all over again because Adobe and Micron and all these like big tech companies are down south about 45 minutes from here. And I live super close to like the tracks, so the train tracks. So basically people can buy a luxury like micro condo that doesn't have a kitchen, and they can get on the train and they can go down and be like minutes from work, so to speak, and then come back and then order in or do their little like Blue Apron or have like a hot plate or whatever. Where they, I'm just like, how can this even be like a new construction? Like, there's no kitchen in that construction. Like, it's crazy to me how people are just like, they don't even want it. They don't even need it because they can just go out, you know, for food or just like disconnect entirely and eat fast food or whatever. You know, it's just disgusting to me.
Yeah. And that's the other thing about, people these days, when thinking that organic or local food is too expensive, it's like, well, how many times a week do you go out to eat?
Right.
You take that money and you put it towards buying a whole chicken. You cook the chicken at the beginning of the week.
You have it all week.
You pick off of it and you make chicken sandwiches. And then by the end of the week, you make chicken stock.
So, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But you know, we're not going in. We want to go in that direction. It would be so much better. I think people want connection and they can get it through cooking and sharing food. But I think that, oh, sorry, my dog's going crazy.
Okay.
I think that, Taro, stop. so many of us are living, like you said, they're living in an apartment that they only sleep in. You know, getting up at the crack of dawn and commuting to go into the city to work to make enough money to pay for the little tiny box that they're only sleeping in and all the food that they're buying from Starbucks and, you know, wherever else
they
go.
The fast food lifestyle, the inflamed prices of the fast food lifestyle, or like, I just feel like food prices in general, and like not even good food, but food's just going up, you know, like at the cost of living is just accelerating and people are not. And this could go like a completely different political direction. So I'm going to try to curb it and we'll bring it back around. But like, you know, like this is the sign of the times. Like, oh, here we are. We have this president who says he's going to do X, Y, and Z for us. You know, meanwhile, the cost of living is getting greater and people aren't making any more. Like minimum wage, like really hasn't inflated or moved with the cost of living in so long. And so now we're just kind of, I have this feeling of like, you know, some days when it seems really bleak, I'm like, we are trapping ourselves into this system that we don't feel like we can get out of. And I totally don't even like blame the people that don't even see it, because like, how could they see it? And they're just trying to keep up with the Joneses and have everything that the American life suggests that we should have. And then they have to eat weird shit, you know what I mean? Because they don't feel like they can afford it. They don't feel like they have any other options because the like general supermarkets don't even like, they greenwash everything and they don't even give you real options. You know, like I go into the Smith's grocery store here and whatever, like you can't even buy, there's just no good options. I go to the West Side store here. It's like a little bit ungentrified, so to speak. The West Side here is not as gentrified as the East Side. And there's like hardly, they just put in an organic vegetable section after like, I think I've been here for 4 years and I hadn't seen just this year. And out of 4 years, like there hasn't been any organic vegetables. And now finally there's like the tiniest little section, you know, I'm like, oh my God, you finally gave these poor people some options.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, like then it gets discounted because nobody will even buy it. Cause nobody even thinks that's like really a thing or whatever. I don't know. It just, it drives me nuts.
Nobody wants to eat an apple or a piece of broccoli, even the poor people. I mean, I know one of your questions is like, what am I passionate about? And I'm passionate about, you know, clean local meat. And the other question you have is like, what's the biggest challenge? And the biggest challenge is cheap food and the lack of education that people have when coming towards food. Joel Salatin, and because poor people who are on food stamps would buy good food if they knew it was good for them and if they knew how to cook it.
Sure.
But because they don't have education, they don't like that food because it tastes gross to them.
Sure.
Joel Salatin has an example of he was donating some of his excess food. His farm, Polyface Farms in Virginia. He was donating some excess food to the homeless shelter, and the homeless shelter had gotten a huge donation of sweet potatoes from a farm, like so many sweet potatoes they just couldn't deal with it all. And Joel was like, "Oh, well, why aren't you like cooking them every night and feeding them to these people who are starving?" And the homeless shelter said, "Because these people don't like them and they won't eat them." Like, even poor people who have nothing won't eat good food because for some reason they don't like it and they don't care.
Well, our American diet's been coated in MSG and corn syrup and all the stuff that like masks food from its real taste or like adulterates food, so to speak. That's what the American palate is these days. Like, I mean, I run into it all the time, quote unquote, in this like Mormon culture, the subculture that exists around us. I mean, I just never grew up Mormon, so I have no idea, but I mean, I've gone to plenty of Mormon functions, so to speak, or Mormon funerals or this or that. And all they do is like everything caked in sugar. You know what I mean? And it's just this thing of like, people don't even know. So like when they start coming out of like the Mormon way, or like some of my friends that are Mormon drink coffee, like they can't get around feeling like they have to dump like so much sugar in their coffee. And I'm like, whoa, like it's just a trip because it's what they're used to. It's what tastes good to them, you know, it's this sugarized like experience. Whereas like, you know, I had recommended a drink to somebody the other day, like, how can you even drink this? It's so bitter. And I think to myself, like, a latte is bitter? Like, that's like espresso like doused down with milk to make it sweet, so to speak, you know. But they had to put sweetener in their coffee to make it even palatable. And I was like, oh, okay, well, my bad, I didn't even know. But anyway, yeah. I just think sugar,
I feel like
it's our worst enemy.
Yeah, and for undereducated poor people, I think if we gave them more opportunities to be a part of community gardens,
sure.
or I know that here in Chico, the Jesus Center has their own garden, I think that they would have a sense of ownership and feel a sense of accomplishment when they grow something that they can eat. And then that experience would hopefully, you know, have this mind-changing emotion where they're like, wow, this cucumber is delicious, I don't need Doritos, you know?
Totally.
When I eat this cucumber, I feel so much better than when I have McDonald's.
Well, it's so funny.
That's what I'm going for. Those are my passions, and that's like the kind of insight that I want to change in people.
Totally. Well, I just also want to make like, can we like make vegetables cool again? Because like, okay, so I have these cultural groups. Like, so I feel like there's like some amount of segregation within this community here anyway, where it's like, there's like refugee populations and there's like the Mexican population that kind of like live in certain like neighborhoods, right? I think that happens in cities. Like people just kind of like tend to flock to where there's going to be like their local supermarket that they can read Spanish labels, or you know what I mean? Like it just kind of ends up all populating in one specific space or another. And there are projects like that out there, like where there's like refugees growing food that's like native to their countries. And it's kind of this interesting conversation that started around like some of the local farms around like, oh, like how do you cook with this thing that we've never really seen before? How do you prepare more traditional dishes? But like those are like second generation or like first generation Americans, but like then they're having kids or they have kids that they brought that don't want anything to do with that food. Like even down to like the Navajo population, the Dene people, like down on the reservations or whatever. I have friends that go down and do some sort of like kind of cultural integration with certain school systems down here. They bring students down to the reservation and they kind of have this like week where they kind of get to know each other and prepare things in a traditional Navajo way and like get to know about that. And so the parents are preparing these like sheep meals, like they're eating sheep, you know, and doing the whole slaughter and you know, they're learning about this closed loop system that exists on the reservation. But then if you go to the store, like the only thing the reservation store stocks is like hot Cheetos and like Mountain Dew, because that's all the kids fucking want to eat, you know, because they're so opposed to their culture that they came from, or feel like it's not progressive, or, you know. And I'm like, oh man, how do you make culture, old cultural practices, cool again, right? We have to be, I'm trying to be that beacon of light, like, hey dude, I'm 31, I'm white as fuck, like, and I love what your family's doing, like, please tell me about, like, why you can't get around, why you, that you don't love what your family's doing, because, like, I wish my family, like, my family, you know, the traditional thing that I remember my grandmother doing was, like, baking bread and rolling lefse, which is, like, a Norwegian thing, and Norwegian lefse is, like, it's, like, bread and sugar, you know, and I'm, like, I'd kill for a thing that was, like, cultural that didn't have, like, white bread written all over it, you know what I mean? Because honestly, where did we lose this, and why is it not cool to be eating vegetables and to be having this connection to the land again? Like, I just don't even understand where we've gotten so off base, because we have it available, there are these communities that are set up, the people that know the ways are trying their hardest, and yet still the people that they're like birthing and passing the stuff down to don't give a fuck. So
yeah,
I don't know. Anyway,
I think we all need to demand better from our food system too. Like, if we all did have the knowledge, everybody would be appalled by what they were eating.
Sure.
From workers being treated badly to putting wood shavings in our shredded cheese because it's a preservative.
Oh my God.
To injecting our chickens with arsenic to make it look pink and fluffier. Like, all these things are ridiculous. There's no reason why we need them if we just took more responsibility for our own food system. And the biggest problem is the lack of knowledge, and yes, the lack of, I guess, empathy. Is that a good, because people aren't thinking about the worker. They're not thinking about the animal. Mm-mm. Or the earth, like, because of all the pesticides and the herbicides. So,
thinking about that are like on the like gorilla end of like everything vegan and animal rights and down with animal everything and PETA and like all, you know, it's like these extremes, you know. It's like, can't we just come to this happy medium of like, we're doing our best and these people, you should support these people, and like like literally just attack these like these things that are totally vile to the environment and our systems. But I don't know. It's like everybody gets lumped into these certain categories, and the blinders get really turned on about like what's real and what's like misinformation or whatever. I feel like we're in the age of misinformation. If we're going to call like Generation X and Y, I'm like, we're Generation Misinformation. Like, this is the people that are, you know, the age of Twitter. Like, Donald Trump is our president and Twitter is our information source. Like, go fuck yourself, you know? Like, it's hard. Anyway, so... okay, so let me see. I feel like we covered like most all of these questions that I just have in front of me, just because we have been on a tangent, which is okay. I'm fine with that. What time do you wake up?
Yeah.
6 a.m., 7 a.m.? What time do you go to sleep? Early enough? Do you think that having routines / rituals in your life have helped you like in a big way in this point, like with farming? Do you feel like having a routine is like essential to your life right now?
Yes. I definitely crave organization and cleanliness, and I love lists.
Are you a Virgo? What are you? What's your sign?
I'm a Cancer.
Moon. Moon.
So yeah, I'm like a total homebody. I love being at home and making a home feel like a home.
Yeah.
And I'm that way for my animals too. Mm-hmm. Like when I move the duck coops or the chicken coops, I have to put everything back just so it looks tidy.
Nice.
And it doesn't look like chaos. Like, chaos to me is too overwhelming. So yeah, if I don't have organization and if things aren't tidy, I get really frantic and I tend to forget things. I'm trying to be better with like digitally planning my life. And since we have a higher, an employee now, I made like a weekly schedule for the farm and a running to-do list and like a daily chore packet, just so all the information is accessible.
A chore packet. Your employee's like, yeah. Oh my God, I just thought I was going to get to hang out at this hippie farm and now I got chore packets. Damn it.
Yeah.
Maniacal.
Didn't know what she was in for.
Nice. Okay. So then I'm going to try to, so one more thing with the farm, and then I want to talk to you about like the Chico Bike and Music Festival for just one second. But okay. As a doer that is going to give advice to future doers or people that want to get involved in the way of doing what you're doing or getting involved in farm culture in general or just a more natural and connected way of life, like what is some wisdom that you might be able to share about your life thus far and like what you think is a good piece of wisdom to leave people with about what you're doing and how to get involved in what you're doing or how to start doing anything, everything.
Yeah. Definitely. So when it comes, happiness comes from loving what you do and working hard every day to attain it and to keep it. So as a doer and for future doers, it's like really do what makes you happy and figure out how you can make money or just figure out how you can live. Off right. of what makes you happy, because if you're happy, money doesn't fucking matter.
Right.
All that matters is waking up and being ready to do what you need to do in the world to feel satisfied when you lay back down at night.
Sure.
Just find happiness in what you do. Always let change work. Change is always going to happen, so you just let it do its work and adapt, especially working with nature. You just let nature do her thing and clean up after her, really. There's no stopping her.
Totally.
There's only nourishing her.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing, too, just going with the change. That's huge.
Yeah. And I guess the other bit of wisdom, like if you specifically are feeling like you really want to get into farming, it's definitely find the community. Because for me, like, I didn't go to school to be a farmer. My husband did, and he took some really great agricultural classes in college, but I didn't. I took more environmental classes. And so farming and the love of the stewardship for the land really came through the people that I surrounded myself by. Mm-hmm. And so I would say definitely immerse yourself in that kind of the community around you, because with farming, it's all about local as well. I really advocate, like, if there's a specific place that you want to farm, go there and farm and find other people around you who are farming, because that's going to be who you lean on, who you ask for advice, who you maybe buy products from, like, because, you know, I'm finding some local farmers just in Oroville, like one of my new idols, her name's Megan Brown, and she raises cattle in Oroville. She has 100 acres, and she also raises heritage hogs. And she's just like a woman farmer just like me, and she's just so powerful and so hardworking that I have somebody I can connect with, you know, who is local and who I can also buy pigs from. And yeah. So we're investing in that relationship with each other. So yeah, I would definitely say find a community.
Yeah. It's always better. Sure. Always better when there's other people. So you don't have to be alone. Like I was, I don't know anybody. There's nobody. Although we would, well, what is that? What is the name of, I was thinking about this when you were talking about fresh chicken CSAs, and we had purchased some fresh slaughtered chickens, like slaughtered that day or like the day before, and we've picked them up at the farm, and they do olives as well. What is the name of that farm? I can't think of it.
It's probably Chapman.
Chapman,
Chapman,
yeah.
Family Farm.
Yes, I bought.
They don't eat chicken anymore.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, you're the chicken replacement.
Chicken.
Well, there you go. So I bought chickens from them, and I was so happy with the chickens. And we ate so many beautiful community family meals. I would make chicken for everybody on the hill. And it was my favorite thing to do is to make that meat, because it was such a lovely piece of meat. And so we could make stews. And, you know, I just really appreciated that community or that localness of my meat source, and was really always so stoked when that chicken slaughter came around. I was like, all right, we're going to do it. We're buying birds, you know? So, yeah, I totally feel that community piece. That was like huge for me. Those little pieces of people. I just remember now the woman that I'm trying to give props to, who taught me how to do everything. Her name is Marilyn. Thank you. I was like, she teaches. Well, she was teaching Wednesday and Saturday knitting at the, was it Yarn Barn? Is that what it's called? The little house that's over on across from S&S. Is it maybe the Yarn Barn? Is it called the Yarn? I don't even know what it's called now.
I don't know.
Heartstring
is over there.
Oh yeah, no, it's Heartstrings is on the other like main street, but there's a little off street, and he was like this tiny cute little house, and the guy is named Bruce, and he owns this little yarn store. I don't think it's called the Yarn Barn, but man, it was the cutest little house to take knitting lessons in. It gave me like some serious amount of sanity from living on the hill. I'd come in just once a week just to like take a knitting class and to chill the fuck out and learn how to knit for real. It was like my favorite thing. Like if I had any free time, I'd like make free time. Like everybody got so annoyed because I'd like get up early and I'd be like, on a Saturday, I'd be like, peace, I'm out to knitting class. And they're all like, yeah, yeah. I'm like, no, but anyway, they were all stoked because I was knitting stuff, but they didn't really care. Okay, so tell me about this festival. So you also, on top of everything else that you do, because this is like already so amazing and like whatever, you also run this festival that happens in Chico, and you've been running it and organizing it for how many years now?
This 2017 was our eighth year
of the Chico. Is it called Chico yeah. Music and Bike Festival, or is it just the Chico Bike Festival?
Chico Bicycle Music Festival.
Bicycle Music Festival. Okay. And tell me a little bit about that, because I went 1 year and I was totally like, I think I got to go see Mom Muse play there, and I was like, oh my gosh, because I got there and everybody was riding bikes to power the stage. It was amazing. I was like, oh my gosh. So tell me what it's about, and tell me how the people participate, and tell me what goes on. Give me a little recap of what you do and how you do it.
Awesome. So yeah, Chico Bicycle Music Festival. It is a nonprofit that supports local music, innovation, and bicycle safety through bicycle parades and games and a music festival. So we start at downtown Chico at the farmers market, and we have a concert there, and usually we have activities. Like last year we had Chicoco, and they decorated bicycles, and then from there we go on a bicycle parade with a live on bike performance, which means that a singer songwriter is sitting on a pedicab and has a wireless microphone and a wireless plug-in for their guitar, and they're performing for us as we're riding our bikes, because broadcasted over our speakers that we are moving with all of our bikes on, like bike carts, and we have a generator that is mobile as well.
Cool.
So live on bike performance through the park. It's very magical and beautiful. And then we get to our last venue. And we set up our stage. It's a bicycle-generated stage, and it's also mobile, so that's what we were hauling our speakers on during the live-on-bike performance. And it has four bikes set up on it where the back tires of the bikes are connected to these, like, bike trainers, and the tire hits this bar. The bar is connected and spinning to a motor, and the motor is connected to a charge controller that's charging a DC deep cycle 27 volt DC deep cycle battery. And then we have a Xantrax inverter that then therefore makes it into AC, and we plug our sound equipment into that and have a concert.
It's insane, you guys. It's completely man-powered. Yeah. It's like, I was like, I've never seen anything like this. I got to the festival and I was like, this is the festival? Like, it's so interactive. And everybody was like, just happy riding bikes behind the performers. It was like, it was beautiful. I have to say, I was like completely blown away. So what do? You organize the whole event or what are you in charge of?
Yeah, I organize the whole event. I basically, in 2009, one of my friends, I was a roadie for a bicycling, a bicycle traveling band. Oh. So, and that band was called the Ginger Ninjas. And in 2009, they were like, hey, let's put on a bike powered concert in Chico and you organize it. And I was like, okay, I'll totally take on all this responsibility and not get paid for it. And I did, and it was great, and I fell in love with it, and I like that's how I found so many people in my community and a lot of my really great friends.
Nice.
And I was living at Grub, so I had that whole community I could pull from. And so I didn't really need anybody else to take on responsibilities because I could do it all, and because nobody else could do it as good as me. I'm just going to brag for a little bit here.
Perfect.
I definitely tried to delegate tasks and people were just not as responsible as I needed them to be.
Sure.
So
that's how it always goes.
And I'm very type A. Yeah. I'm a perfectionist and it paid off, you know, 8 years later, the festival is kind of flawless. I know all of the ins and outs. I know like somebody might cancel. There's going to be a typo. I have to double check to call this person to make sure they're doing this thing right. You know, I have to overbook my volunteers because people always cancel.
Sure.
That kind of knowledge that I have now. So yeah, I'm doing it all. I'm making the phone calls. I'm booking the artists and the venue. I'm asking for the sponsorships. I'm double checking the poster. I'm printing the t-shirts. I'm distributing the flyers.
Wow.
And then on the day of the festival, I'm like setting it all up and I'm breaking it all down and I'm checking in with all the volunteers.
And you still have a good time? It's not something where you're like, holy shit, I don't, are you just like completely like in go mode and you just don't even think about it until it's over and then you're like, that was fun, I'll do it again. But are you just keeping it going because it's like the thing that you've done for this long? Or, I mean, like, is it fun for you? Tell me about that.
Yeah, the first couple of years, it was just go, go, go. And, like, I was younger, so I had – and I definitely have tons of energy. Don't get me wrong. I'm, like, a go, go, go all the time. So I was definitely feeling it. I was into it. I loved who I was as an event planner. Event planning was new to me, so it was still interesting and logistically fun. Having fun didn't come until more people started really helping me on the day of. Last year, I was like the most relaxed I've ever been, and I had fun. I actually got to like have conversations with people instead of just have a hi, how are you, and then I have to run off and do something else.
Sure.
But I do have fun, but I am, this was my last year doing the festival.
All right. So you're retired.
I want to focus on, I'm a little retired. I'm still going to help the nonprofit who technically owns the festival, because sure, all the money that the festival makes and all the equipment that I buy with that money is owned by the nonprofit, Butte Environmental Council. And they see that they have a gem, so they want to do it again next year. So I'm going to be mentoring them.
Sure.
But I don't want to be the one calling the venues and the bands. I need somebody else to do that now.
There you go. Put your foot down. You're done. You've done 8 years. You're done.
Yeah, I'm ready to do Turkey Tail and Turkey Tail only.
Good. That's awesome. I'm happy for you. It sounds like I mean, 8 years is a great run. It's not like you were like, fuck this, I'm not doing this. But you did put your 8 years in. It's like a 10-year, you know, and now you're done. Retiring. So.
Yeah, I got them the generator. They can take it from there.
Exactly. We good. Well, girl, I think that you have just been so great. This conversation has been so good. It's been so inspiring to me to hear a little bit about what your day looks like, what your life looks like, what your dreams look like for now and forever. And, you know, like, I love knowing that there's somebody out there like you that is doing this work, you know, and really being such a beautiful beacon of light for the farming industry as we know it, you know, and doing the local farming thing with such pizzazz. It's great. It's like, it's refreshing. And I'm so excited that I got to showcase you on this first podcast, and you know, hopefully maybe you'll come back and talk about more political stuff in the future.
I would love to. Yeah, let's debate. I'll get all my facts and quick notes.
I know. I was like, okay, we're going to talk about all this stuff, and then somebody inevitably is going to be like, and that's not true because this and this fact. I'm like, okay, I can already see, like, we're like generalizing and putting everything into like little boxes, and somebody's going to come rip the boxes down, which is fine. I welcome that kind of stuff. Like, I think that freedom of speech is amazing. That's why we have it. And we're just talking like two people talk. So of course we probably got some stuff wrong and probably overemphasize certain stuff, but I think on a whole it's amazing to hear how passionate you are about everything, and I think that's excuse me, it's what I'm trying to call in, is having conversations, passionate conversations about what people love and like ways of engaging people in the conversation about life as we know it being different for some people and same for other people, and you know, like just kind of getting to tap in and meet some of the people that I really think are living these kind of like unique and dedicated lives that are sometimes about, you know, the folk art practice, sometimes about farm culture, all these things, they all go hand in hand and like are really just at the end of the day like what they, these kinds of relationships and these the knowledge that you even exist enriches my life. So I'm like, I just feel like really just honored that you were on the show and we could even talk a little bit about everything that you do and just even start to touch on how amazing and dedicated you guys are to your farm, because I can feel, I can feel it through the phone. So,
yay, so thank you so much, Moon.
Oh, of course. So, okay. So then to finally just wrap us off, like, how do we stay in touch with you? Like, tell people, can we email you? What's your Instagram? Like, how do people find you and seek you out more if they want to know and follow your story more closely?
Awesome. Yeah. So we are on Facebook at Turkey Tail Farm, Instagram at Turkey Tail Farm. We have a website, www.turkeytailfarm.net or .com. We own both of those.
Nice. Hell yeah.
And if you want to email us, you can do info@turkeytailfarm.net or .com.
Cool.
And then we're both very active on Instagram. My husband loves to do lots of sciencey posts and stuff. So if you're just interested in learning more about plants and animals, definitely start to follow us. If you are interested in local pasture-raised, humanely harvested food, you know, find us on the internet and we'll try and get it to you. I'm not opposed to shipping.
There you go. Local shipper there.